afternoon. Welcome to the Queensland Country Hour. My name's Ali Felton-Taylor. Coming up, Queensland rail workers have a huge job ahead of them in the state's northwest. A massive 300 kilometres of rail between Huendon and Cloncurry damaged in that monsoonal bad weather earlier this month. QR won't commit to a time frame on the repair of the line just yet.
I wouldn't put a time right on it today, but I think as we get to the course of this week, and early the next week, I'm hopeful that we'll have a far better picture of those timeframes.
We're also going to hear from a fourth-generation dairy farmer who's tearing up his contract with Norco. That's the cooperative that supplies Coles with its dollar a litre farm brand milk. Also, we'll talk about the price of wool too. First, though, Tropical Cyclone Omar is now looking less likely to cross the southern Queensland coast. It's currently offshore, about 950 kilometres northeast of Brisbane. We'll speak to the Weather Bureau soon, but now let's cross to the Sunshine Coast, where our reporter Jennifer Nichols has been watching the Category 2 system closely. Hello, Jen.
G'day, Ali. And as you may have just heard on the news, a cyclone watch has been issued for an area of coastline from Bundaberg to Ballina, including Brisbane, the Sunshine Coast and Gold Coast. And locally here, all of the shark nets have been taken out of the water. We have 15 beaches closed to swimmers because of hazardous surf. And just about every vantage point near the ocean is lined with people watching the waves crash in and some pretty crazy windsurfers out in a amongst it. But apart from the conditions at the beach, it's been pretty much an average day here, Ali. It's nice and sunny this morning and just a few clouds hanging around now. I guess the focus really is on being prepared for the fact cyclones are unpredictable. And as you heard yesterday from my chat with Darren Logan down at Mooloola River Fisheries, the commercial port at Mooloolaba is just chock-a-block with vessels back in safe harbour. And I recently just spoke to Vanessa Hughes from Rocklift Seafoods, who says crews have been kept very, very busy tying down boats and clearing the wharves.
It's been a very difficult one because it keeps changing every time you sort of look at the forecast. So we've had to sort of err on the side of caution. So basically the main thing that we've been looking at is making sure that we're clearing the wharf and the factory area of anything that might possibly blow away in a strong wind. And then also too, we need to make sure that all of the boats are secure on the wharf, which has meant, you know, extra ropes, tying them up a lot stronger, making sure they're in a position that they're not going to get into any trouble.
So that's a pretty big undertaking considering you supply spanner crabs, scallops and ocean king prawns there.
Yes, it is pretty full on, but luckily like a lot of the fishermen are looking after their own boat, so that side of it they're taking very good care of, and we're doing mainly the actual on the wharf stuff, making sure everything's been put away and cleared up, and potentially if there was any sort of inundation, that making sure everything's up high enough.
What's it meant for business?
Well, obviously all the boats are in. For us, particularly with the spanner crab, we have a strong demand for that. And yeah, it looks like, the way it looks at the moment, they potentially won't get out for at least a week or so. So it will be a bit of a downturn from that perspective while we're waiting for them to get back out to sea again.
Have you got much frozen product that you can keep supply up with at the moment?
Yes, we do have frozen products and also with the prawns and things like that. So from that perspective, everything will keep ticking over. However, we did cancel our processing for tomorrow. We were planning to process some scallops, but we decided to cancel that with the prediction of strong gusty winds. And at that stage, they were still predicting quite heavy rain, which meant that, you know, there'll be possible inundation on the wharf. So we made the call, and we actually had a Department of Agriculture export accreditation audit booked for tomorrow, and we actually had to cancel that because we just didn't want to risk it with our staff.
Oh, well, it sounds like it's a big upheaval for you, but I suppose it's part of the game, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. When you're in primary production like this, you've got to ride with the waves, I guess, and there's always going to be ups and downs, and you just keep getting on with it and go from there.
And Rocklift Seafoods is a real family affair, you're saying, Vanessa?
Yes, that's right. It's my parents' business, and then we have my three brothers and myself all involved in differing aspects.
And at least then you can take some of the load and care for each other during this sort of thing, because it's just so unpredictable. I mean, we may not get anything much, but we just don't know.
Yes, that's right. And I think that's been the hardest thing. We've sort of had to sit down and sort of say, well, okay, it might not be anything, but if it is, what are we going to do about it? So we've, like I said, decided to err on the side of caution and take the precautions to keep everything safe.
And how big's your fleet and how many other fishers do you get supplied from?
We have a spanner crab boat, and we also have another vessel that's down south with fresh fish. And then there's probably, I would say, about 15 prawn vessels that moor here and unload here. And then a number of other spanner crab vessels as well that unload to us.
So that's a lot of activity on the wharf to make sure they're all tied down safely.
Yes, yes. It's been a hive of activity down here. There's been a bit of a buzz with all the fishermen getting together and trying to work out what's going to happen and make sure they've got everything secure. And, yeah, it's been very busy.
In the past, have you had to weather many big storms there?
Not while we've been here. There's been lots of stories from fishermen about 1974 and then way back in 1954 when there was a cyclone in the area. And that sort of told a story about the yacht club lifting out of its pylons and floating down the river. But at that stage, our wharf wasn't there. So it's, I think they're all sort of thinking, well, I hope that doesn't happen again. But generally, I mean, it gets windy and it gets, you know, we have your rough weather and we've had bouts of where the boats have been in for a couple of weeks with bad weather. But you just roll with it and wait till it comes right again. So it's just slightly different because of this system being a cyclone and not really knowing what to expect.
That's Vanessa Hughes from Rockcliffe Seafoods on the Sunshine Coast. Now, we of course know about the huge amount of rain that fell in the north, but it's been a while since there's been a cyclone down this far, isn't it, Jennifer Nichols?
Yeah, that's right, Ali. The most recent time we had an impact was from severe tropical cyclone Debbie back in March 2017. And we got the tail end of that, really, but we've still got a heap of flash flooding and coastal erosion and even some mini tornadoes out of that. And there was Cyclone Marsha, had effects from that in 2015. Yasi in 2011, of course, caused flash flooding and coastal erosion. But we haven't had really big cyclone on the coast since 1954 and 1967. Although I do remember as a kid in 1974 when one of the cyclones went over and every single panel of our old Queenslander roof leaked and we had saucepans out everywhere. So, yeah, it's a case of we're really wanting some rain, but not too much of it. And my ABC colleagues attended a briefing with local disaster management committees this morning who said we could still expect up to 150 millimetres of rain for the next 3 days. Now, that's a maximum. And that really, if we get those maximums, that really wouldn't be welcome for local pineapple growers because they've just started their harvest and they're also planting. And I spoke to Gordon Oakes from Verriadale. He's got both pineapples and cane in the ground with his brother. And he was telling me they do desperately need rain, just not too much of it.
Oh, if we could just get some nice steady rain without the heavy downpours, it'd be good. We're reasonably dry at the moment. We've had our driest December and January that I can remember for a long time, if not ever. And yeah, we're very dry at the moment, but we could do some rain, but last thing we want is heavy downpours of hundreds of millimetres.
Where are your crops at the moment?
We're harvesting pineapples at the moment, and they don't like great big amounts of rain and heat afterwards. It'll boil the internals of them, and we're freshly planting some at the moment. So, yeah, the freshly planted ones will get washed out of the ground. We'll get a lot of erosion.
So you're hoping that it turns out to sea and just brings a little bit of nice steady rain then, Gordon Oakes?
That'd be beautiful.
And what about the cane crop?
Yeah, it's very drought affected for our normal conditions down here, yeah.
Because the harvesting's over for the season, isn't it?
Yeah, harvesting's over. It should be just in the growing mode, but the cane's hardly grown since December. It's just been affected from the dry really bad.
How long have you and your brother been farming in that area now?
Well, our family's been here growing cane since 1936, and we've both been here since we left school, virtually. I've been here since I left school, and my brother done a trade after school and come home afterwards.
And how would you describe the climatic conditions at the moment, given that you've got such a long period to reflect on?
The last 2 years have just been very spasmodic. It's been either wet or dry and nothing in between. It's yet. This is our second year of very poor pineapple crops because we suffer from the wet 1 minute and the dry a few months later. It's just been all of one or all of the other.
How much land have you got under cane and pineapples?
Oh, about over 800 acres now.
So that's quite a sizeable farm for our district, given that it's had so much encroachment from development.
Yeah, definitely, yeah, yep.
Gordon, I really hope that you get some good rain and not too much.
Yeah, but after what the blokes have had up north now, I don't think we have any say over what we want. Yeah, we were just talking to the pineapple growers from Townsville yesterday, and my brother just went up to visit them last week to see how they're going. And yeah, the rain was really bad, and now they've got hot weather, and it's just burning all the plants off. It's going to kill them. They could lose everything they're going to harvest in the next few weeks, and it'll impact on the supply a little bit. Yeah, definitely.
Anything else that I've missed there, Gordon, that you want to tell me about?
Oh, not really. I'll win forever. To be totally honest, we are a little bit worried about the rain, but yeah, we can't do anything about it. But yeah, hopefully they're just scaremongering us. But yeah, if we do get hundreds of millimetres of rain, it's not going to be pretty.
I think it's just too early to tell yet, but I guess we've got to watch things really closely.
Yeah, cyclones can do anything. They can go anywhere and do anything.
That's Gordon Oakes, a pineapple and cane farmer from Verriadale on the Sunshine Coast. And Ali, it's really a case of wait and watch and be prepared and really hope for the best.
Indeed, we will check in with the Bureau after 12:30. But Jennifer Nichols, thanks for catching us up on the latest.
Absolute pleasure.
Jennifer Nichols, our reporter in the Sunny Coast. It's 16 past
12. You're listening to the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Well, to resources news now, and Glencore announced overnight it will not be increasing its production of coal in the future, citing climate change as a main factor. The multi-billion dollar company says increasing pressure from shareholders and major climate action groups led to the decision. But the news hasn't worried coal miners in the Bowen Basin, with the state president of the Mining and Energy Division of Construction, Forestry, Mining and Energy Union, or the CFMEU, Stephen Smyth, telling Melanie Groves he hopes it'll be business as usual.
Obviously Glencore can read the market, but it depends on what they say about not increasing their coal production. They're the largest thermal coal producer in Australia, one of the largest in the world. They're the second largest coal producer in Australia, so clearly they're also a commodity trader, so they're watching the market, so they're obviously considering where they sit and want to place themselves moving into the future. So it's a real bit of a watch and see, but we still think coal's got a bright future. And we certainly think that everything needs to be done to ensure that there's no oversupply, because we don't want to oversupply the market either. We just want to make sure that the market maintains at the level it is and the people are kept in secure, well-paid employment.
You're meeting with Glencore about this. What are you hoping to achieve from that?
We're meeting with them about a number of matters, but we're meeting with them about an agreement for the Hale Creek mine. So really our focus with them is to get the Hale Creek agreement done and hopefully put away any uncertainty, which there isn't at that mine, and get on with business, yeah.
Collinsville is one of those communities that's had a lot of issues with mines in that region. Have you heard from anyone on the ground about this latest update?
No, we haven't, and I would think it'll filter through in the next few days, and when the people in the market actually look at what it means, and then we get people to actually crunch the numbers and see what it really looks at, then people could probably make an informed decision, and people will then be probably asking the questions that, what does this really mean for me? We'd like to think it just means business as normal. If Glencore decide to cap their coal levels at where they're at, that means that the mines they've got continue to operate, the mines they've got continue to provide jobs and employment.
The Bowen Basin town of Collinsville has had a rocky history with Glencore, following intermittent production and job losses from 2013. But Collinsville-based Workwear business owner David Evans says the mood surrounding the coal industry is positive.
From what we've heard to date, it's business as usual. Current production levels will be maintained, and they're not reducing production or at this stage have any intention of scaling back their operations. So I think there was a positive aspect to that announcement as well. I think those of us that are in mining towns near Glencore operations can have some confidence that it will be just business as usual.
So you're not too concerned about any change. Collinsville is a community that does rely fairly heavily on the coal mining industry around it for the economy. What would a decline or a change in that industry mean for Collinsville?
Look, there's absolutely no prospect of a decline or change at the moment. There are two major mining companies in Collinsville. One's Glencore at the Collinsville Coal Operation, and the other is Q Coal. And both are expanding production at the moment. Currently, the biggest problem they've all got in the area is actually getting the coal through the port at Abbott Point. There are currently 29 ships at anchor off Abbott Point waiting to be loaded. The coal industry is not in decline in spite of what you hear from national media. Production levels are high and pricing has never been better. So I think people need to take a reality check and get some real facts on where the industry is heading at the moment, and it's all positive.
What's the attitude of people on the ground in Collinsville at the moment, given the price of coal and the current levels of production?
Well, obviously, there's a lot of additional employment. The companies are making money. As I say, the biggest problem at the moment is just getting it shipped through the port, and that's where it is. It's all go. There's no slowdown at all.
So everyone's feeling fairly positive and happy about that?
Most definitely. There's nothing to feel negative about at the moment with the industry.
That's David Evans, a workwear business owner in Collinsville, speaking there with Melanie Groves. Well, Queensland Rail is uncertain how long the Townsville to Mount Isa rail line will be closed due to flood damage, but says it will be less than the 6 to 12 months that has been widely reported. QR CEO Nick Easy says 204 sites have sustained extreme erosion, with 40 kilometres of major track washouts, 20 kilometres of track scouring and 16 bridges damaged in the heavy monsoon rain and flooding event. Mr. Easy began by addressing concerns about the Pacific National train that was derailed at Neelia that was carrying lead and zinc concentrate, and what's being done to salvage the wreck.
Well, the PN train was obviously stowed on what was traditionally safe ground during previous flooding events. So with this unprecedented flooding event, the area under the tracks was washed away, and that led to tipping of a number of the wagons on the consist, and that also resulted in the loss of product. The train was carrying zinc and lead product, and therefore the key thing here is it's a very important line. It's very important for the economy and the region, but also here we're ensuring that the environmental aspects of this product spill and the management of that is of highest priority. So our key thing is to develop a recovery plan. We've only just had access to this site, so water has cleared away. We've got a crust that's developed on the top of the surface, but it's still quite soft and boggy underneath. So we've got people on the ground at the moment fencing off an area around the train. We'll have environmental consultants on the ground tomorrow, and we'll start to fine-tune the recovery process, which is about the product, rescue of the train, and then ultimately remediation of the track. We will start a sampling program to get better data and information in relation to the product, the spill, and whether that's been mobilised. These products, they do have low solubility. They are heavy in nature. So in terms of mobilisation through the sampling program, we'll get better information moving forward.
It's zinc and lead concentrate, was my understanding, which is like dirt, isn't it? And there's copper anode, which is a big chunk of metal. Is that correct? And what are the environmental impacts or the concerns, or even for people getting there to start any clean-up or repairs? Is there any safety concerns with that?
Well, at the moment, we've had the site handed over to us from Queensland Fire and Emergency Service. It wasn't declared a hazmat site from their point of view, so they've handed control over to us. We've got an exclusion zone around the immediate vicinity of the train site, which is a 20-metre exclusion zone. We've got appropriate PPE that'll be worn in that zone. We'll do the sampling, and will give us better information on the management. As I said, the sampling will give us better information around how far and if the material has spread. We know some of it was moved given the ferocity of the floodwaters and the amount of water in that area.
Have you got a length of track in total that's damaged that has to be repaired? Like, is it, you're talking a kilometre, 2 kilometres, just little small bits, or is it extensive damage?
Look, it does vary. There's probably in the order of 40 kilometres of washouts that need to be remedied and about 20 kilometres of scour damage in addition to the bridges. So, you know, we have some quantification. It's now about working through the plan and how we optimise resources, plant and equipment to work through that. So, again, I wouldn't put a time right on it today, but I think as we get to the course of this week, and early to next week, I'm hopeful that we'll have a far better picture of those timeframes. But what we are doing is giving an enormous amount of focus, and we will do everything we can for our customers and for the community to bring this area of track back up into operation.
I understand your reluctance to, until you know better, you've been up there and properly assessed it, to give a time frame. But are you talking like weeks or months? Can you give me some sort of indication on that?
Well, look, the only statement we've made on timeframes is that we're well ahead of what's been previously reported at 6 to 12 months. But what I'll do, Bruce, is when I think that we're in a better position to provide some reliable timeframes, we'll certainly communicate that.
That's Nick Easy. He's the CEO of Queensland Rail, speaking there with ABC News journalist Bruce Atkinson, 26 past 12.
The Country Hour. On ABC Radio Queensland.
The ongoing milk wars. A fourth generation dairy farmer is declaring he'd rather shut his dairy than continue to supply Coles after the retail giant refused to increase milk prices the same week as its competitor Woolworths agreed to up the price per litre. Woolworths will charge consumers an extra 10 cents a litre for milk to support farmers. As yet, Coles and Aldi have not moved the price they charge. Farmer Paul Weir supplies Norco and says he's disgusted with Coles, and he's so disgusted that he's breaking his contract with the dairy cooperative, which supplies the supermarket giant for its home brand $1 a litre milk. He supplies 2.5 million litres of milk a year to Norco, putting him in the top 10% of the processor's suppliers. And he told Kim Honan, despite being in the industry for 145 years, he'd rather shut down than continue to be treated this way by Coles.
Angry. Yeah, very angry. Full credit to Woolworths for doing it, but Coles, yeah, words can't describe how angry and disappointed we are with Coles' stand.
Once Woolies announced that, did you expect that Coles would follow? I mean, was that the expectation among Norco suppliers?
I think with across all suppliers across the country, I thought it was, you know, that they would. I mean, it just makes common sense. We're in one of the worst droughts in history, milk's dropping down to one of the lowest records in a long time, in 20 or 30 years the milk level's been, and local milk and all the milk around here, everyone's doing it real tough. Feed costs have gone through the roof, everyone's making a loss, and yet here they are just trying to make a commercial gain against their major competitor. It's pathetic.
Coles has called for an industry-wide levy, but as long as that was applied to all retailers and across all milk products, would that make any difference? Would that work?
No. The fundamentals of this problem is milk is being sold well below the cost of production, and it needs to go up. It's a fundamental. We don't need levies. They just want to treat us like paupers and like beggars. And I'm sorry, but we're too proud of what we do to actually take out handouts. The fundamental problem is it is well underneath the cost of production. And if this industry is going to be sustainable, we need a price rise across the whole dairy cabinet, milk, cheese, yogurts, butter, the whole lot. The domestic price, the Coles discounting of it has actually is sending the whole industry to the wall.
So with Woolworths lifting its price, how far ahead of Norco has that put Parmalat suppliers in terms of price?
Well, when you work out the figures, it could work out to be, you know, across a whole 12-month annualised, probably potentially 5 or 6 cents a litre, you know, and that is massive. That's certainly an issue that Norco are going to have to address. But, you know, for me and my family, it is we just don't want to supply Coles anymore. And yeah, I sent an email to Norco this week stating that, you know, I will be seeking, unless Coles play the game, I will be seeking to get out of my contract with Norco. I just don't want to supply them. Their business values and mine just don't agree. I choose not to do business with people like that, and I don't want any of my milk going through a Coles for them to make profit out of it while I'm sitting here making a loss on it.
How long's left in your Norco contract and how much is it going to cost for you to break it?
Yeah, well, realistically, I theoretically would have, you know, probably three and a half years left, and it's going to cost me a fair cent to get out of it. But as I said, this is a principled stand that I intend to take. And at the end of the day, you know, you're sitting here making a loss anyway. So to get out of it, another few tens of thousands. I haven't actually sat down and actually fully worked out what it is, but that's beside the problem. I would much prefer, I'd prefer to give my milk away than actually in front of a Coles shop, than actually let Coles sell it as a loss and just for them to profiteer on it.
Well, the chairman and acting CEO of Norco has said that if retailers, including Coles, didn't lift their price, they'd be dumped as customers by Norco. Would you like to see him stick to his word?
I'd be all for it. I would be all for it. I have had a private discussion before I sent the email with Greg, and I personally, whilst we can't afford a pay cut, you know, my personally, like I said, I would be happy to do it, because their business principles and mine just don't align, and hence I'm seeking to not supply Coles, you know, any company that supplies Coles.
That's Paul Weir. He's a Norco supplier, speaking there with Kim Honan. Now, the Country Hour has contacted Coles, and in a written response, it has said, Coles has been exploring additional options in relation to how to best support Australia's hardworking farmers and is committed to finding a better model that can be adopted by the industry. In the meantime, Coles will continue to look at ways to support Australian farmers, including by collecting customer donations at our supermarket registers and matching them dollar for dollar. Coles also knows that many customers in Australia face cost of living pressures and doesn't want them to be disadvantaged through price increases. Now, we've also contacted Norco for comment but haven't received any response back. But the Norco chairman and acting CEO, Greg McNamara, is speaking at the Australian Dairy Conference in Canberra today. So we hope to bring you some response from Norco in this week's news, at least indeed by the end of the week. Soon on the Country Hour, we're going to check in with the response of pasture and indeed some threats of weeds spreading after those huge monsoonal rains in the grazing country in the Gulf. Also, droughts biting hard in southern areas. Many people affected are feeding off forage sorghum, but there's a huge warning that perhaps it could kill stock if there's a certain level of acid detected in it. We're also going to look at the wool price. It's jumped about a dollar for every micron category, so we'll find out why that is. Now, though, let's check in with Lydia Burton. She's got the latest news headlines.
Good afternoon, Ali. Police say they're concerned about a missing man last seen in Mount Isa. 37-year-old Peter English was travelling to Caboolture from Mount Isa and hasn't made contact with family for 9 days. It's believed he's travelling in a dark grey Ford FG Falcon sedan with a New South Wales registration FPV849 and could be travelling to Mackay or returning home. Police ask if people do have information to get in touch. If we head to South Australia, there's some news there around genetically modified crops and the moratorium that the state government had, and the fact that that moratorium has cost farmers $33 million since 2004. That's according to an independent review by Professor Kim Anderson, which specifically looked at the economic effects of the ban. South Australia's Primary Industries Minister Tim Whetstone says the state government will now consider the findings of that report. So we could expect news in the future from South Australia as to whether they'll allow genetically modified crops. Ali, of course, there'll be more news at 1 o'clock.
Thanks very much, Lydia Burton. And indeed, all our stories, or indeed most of our stories, are on the ABC website, abc.net.au/rural, or just put ABC Rural in your search engine. We're going to crack on now because it is 28 minutes to one on the Queensland Country Hour and check in with the Weather Bureau. The senior forecaster there, or indeed the forecaster there, is Lauren Paddy, because you're a bit new to this patch, Lauren Paddy, aren't you?
Well, I'm new to the senior forecasting role, yes, so only done it for a little while, and it's maybe a good time or not so good time to be the senior forecaster here at the Bureau.
Absolutely.
There's a lot going on.
There is a lot going on. Let's first look at the cyclone northeast of Brisbane at this stage. Will it cross the coast? The latest seems to be that it may not.
Yeah, Tropical Cyclone Omar. She's sitting about 890 kilometres to the northeast of Brisbane at the moment. She's moving slowly towards the southwest towards us. She has slowed a little bit in her track towards us overnight. We still expect to approach the coast. However, it all depends on a ridge to the south. So because she slowed down a little bit, that ridge to the south is able to strengthen a little bit. And because of that, while we still expect to see significant conditions for coastal communities and just adjacent inland parts, particularly with some wind and that surf and swell we'll talk about in a minute, we do expect her at this stage to stay little bit offshore. However, it is a little bit uncertain over the weekend as to how close she comes. There's still a lot of uncertainty. It's not the easiest cyclone to forecast the track of. It's actually quite a difficult one. There's a few different factors at play, which makes it a little bit difficult. But the moral of the story is she will approach the coast. We expect her to slow down a little bit and move towards the northwest, almost parallel to the coast. And as she does so, bringing with her some swell. We've already started to see the swell pick up on our beaches around the southeast. We expect that to continue, the winds. We've already see some strong winds about the southeast. We expect that to pick up to a gale force by the time we get to Friday. And even into the weekend, we could see some storm force winds, particularly offshore and those exposed islands. So it's something else to consider. We do have a watch. That watch extends from Ballina, which is in northern New South Wales, all the way up to Bundaberg. So that includes Brisbane, Sunshine Coast and the Gold Coast, so all of the big cities down the southeast. Could see some possible gales by the time we get into Friday and the weekend.
Lauren Paddy, rainfall, that's at the top of people's mind. How much and where?
Rainfall is probably the trickiest forecast out of all of this. So we are, the wind and the swell, we expect that to come regardless of how close Omar comes towards the coast. However, the rainfall one is determined by how close she is. So yesterday, it did look like she would move a little bit quicker towards us, and as such, that rainfall will extend a little bit further inland. But because she's moving a little bit slower and that ridge gets in first a little bit quicker, things have eased off in the rainfall department in our forecast. So you'll see the numbers probably dropped a great deal overnight. And that was just because of her slow track and that ridge strengthening behind it. It's still uncertain. We could still see some heavy falls, particularly on Sunday and into Monday. So on Sunday, the areas that we do expect to see most of that heavy falls would be the Sunshine Coast, northwards into the Wide Bay. Better chance the closer you are to the coast, further inland. As far inland as places like even Toowoomba, Gympie, you could see some rainfall in that region, but probably not quite the heavy falls that we're predicting yesterday. Still some decent rainfall. You could see up to 50 millimetres in places in those inland regions as well. And that continues into Monday. So hopefully she comes close enough to bring us some good rainfall, but not the flooding kind of rainfall. So it's a little bit of a delicate balancing act for the rainfall at the moment.
What about other parts of the state? We're focusing in on this southern part. Fine everywhere else?
For the most part, we do have a surface trough at the moment. It is sitting somewhere from about St. Lawrence down towards Toowoomba and Warwick and the border. We see some showers and storms about on that trough today. That trough moves towards the northwest tomorrow. So tomorrow it sits from about Quilpie, Claremont into Bowen. See some showers and storms on that, but no great totals out of anything there. And though any falls there will be quite isolated.
Lauren Paddy, thanks very much for your time today. Indeed, ABC Local Radio Queensland will be keeping people up to date with the watch situation on that cyclone, and we'll get all the latest details for boaties in that as well. But thanks very much for your time.
No problem. Thank you.
Cheerio. Senior forecaster at the Bureau, Lauren Paddy.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Well, despite being pummeled by drought, then severe flooding, a pasture specialist from the state government says the resilience of Mitchell grass in the northwest of the state has been incredible. David Phelps is from QDAF at Longreach. He says the heightened speed of the floods caused widespread erosion and silt build-up. But he says the response of annuals and grasses indeed is actually very patchy.
These areas where the water's just been rushing so quickly across the top of Mitchell Grass country that it's taken off the top few inches of the soil, and it's even got into the cracks and just gouged those out, forming little mini creeks, basically. And the depth of water across just open Mitchell Grass country is staggering as well. There's debris in the top wire of fences in places that you'd normally just see, you know, just a little bit of water running off, not 1 or 1.5 metres of water depth.
What's mostly kicking off now in terms of pastures and or forbs?
Most of what's responding across Mitchell Grass country, at least, is there's a mix of flinders, cowvine, tarvine, a few other herbages, and in many places the Mitchell Grass itself is starting to shoot.
How have these grasses been able to hang in there for all of those years of drought? Just amazes me. You know, Mitchell Grass I know has deep roots, but it's impressive stuff, isn't it, to survive all of that and then this?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. That's right. To go through 6 or 7 years of drought and then copper hiding like this as well, and yet still be able to respond in some places, that is an incredible grass, that's for sure.
What about the scoured out areas? Are you able to categorise land types and damage types and the response of grasses?
We will be able to over time. At the moment, I guess where I've been seeing the worst impacted areas in terms of being scoured out is the creeks, and depending on where you are, a couple of kilometres either side of those creeks, where the water's obviously just been rushing so quickly that it's scoured out the soil. In some places it has torn Mitchell Grass plants out of the ground and carried them off to who knows where. And it's pretty hard to say how big an area that might be at the moment. But unfortunately, those areas, particularly adjacent to the creek lines, they're not going to grow very much feed at all. They'd be lucky to grow sort of 50 or 100 kilograms of dry matter per hectare over the coming weeks or months.
What about as you follow like the likes of the Flinders River up into the Gulf, what about all of that country? How's it likely to respond, do you believe?
Amy, I was able to get just up into a little bit of the Bull Mitchell country, and Bull Mitchell likes it wet. And wherever the soil's just started to dry out enough, the Bull Mitchell's starting with a green shoot from the base, so that's a really good sign. I would expect the Bull Mitchell country to grow probably a tonne or a tonne and a half of feed after this, and the bluegrass brown top pastures, I'd expect much the same. When you get out away from the areas that normally flood, however, and that could be anything from a kilometre to 4 or 5 kilometres out from the normal floodplains, those pastures might suffer, particularly buffle grass on sandier soils or areas of Curly Mitchell and other pastures that don't normally flood. If they've been under for a couple of weeks, for instance, there could well be an impact there. Although Mitchell grass can generally stand being underwater for about 10 days, and buffle grass generally can stand underwater for about 5 days.
Incredible. What about the red country?
The red country that I've seen so far is coming away quite nicely, actually. And I guess what's happening there is that the red country being lighter, it drains faster. And buffle, for instance, that's in redder soils that hasn't been underwater, there's already sort of 500 to 600 kilos per hectare of good quality buffle grass growing in some places. So some of the red country is coming away quite nicely. Some of the pebbly country is coming away quite nicely. And it's the heaviest clay soils that have been underwater that are yet to respond.
So how are graziers in the next weeks and months going to get a handle on what their country is producing now? You're talking kilos per hectare. How do people maybe approach fodder budgets?
As much as I promote doing fodder budgets, at the moment I can imagine people have got more things on their minds, but as a bit of a rule of thumb, if they have Mitchell grass up to about 20 centimetres of height, generally there'll be about 600 kilos per hectare of dry matter there. And I guess what is good is that it will all be high quality feed. It'll be high in energy, it will be high in protein, highly digestible, and also high in moisture. So that might alleviate some of the the concerns about livestock being able to get into to drink, for instance, when there is 85 or 90% moisture in the pasture, it certainly acts as a good supplement for water intake as well as protein and energy.
David Phelps, he's a principal scientist with QDAF in Longreach, speaking there with Amy Phillips. David Phelps also said pastures that have been lightly dusted with silt should strike, although it will be slower. Now, staying up in that Gulf Country after that huge rain event, concerns have also turned to the spread of weeds by floodwaters. Scientific advisor for the Invasive Species Council of Australia, Tim Lowe, told Anita Bolle he'd like to see Biosecurity Queensland take a proactive lead in woody weed control.
Loss of pasture, difficulty of access to watercourses because of, you know, prickly, woody groves of foreign plants, in some cases unpalatable plants, some cases poisoning. I mean, there's a whole gamut of weeds out there. And, of course, the problem is that, you know, the cattle, sheep, they'll eat the nice plants, you know, the ice cream plants. The stuff that's left is therefore in a good position to increase, and often it is these undesirable weeds. Actually, there's a whole other issue we haven't mentioned, which is fodder drops, you know, that if fodder's being brought in to feed hungry cattle, if that fodder's come from hundreds of kilometres away, then there's a good chance that's going to have some seeds mixed in with it that could bring in weeds that are not already in that area.
Is there a concern that some of the hay might be carrying these types of seeds?
Yes, look, it's well documented. So there are a number of reports where agricultural scientists have assessed fodder, you know, actually gone through fodder and looked at past fodder drops. And we know this happens, so there's no question that it is a regular, you know, it's a regular event. So, I mean, there is clear advice there, you know, should a landholder look around where your fodder has been placed to see if any weird weeds come up. But it's not that simple, because if the cattle have eaten the seeds and things pop up in their dung, they could be at the other end of the paddock. And of course, at the moment, a lot of paddocks have lost their fences. So, you know, these weed seeds could be germinating quite a long way away from where there's a fodder drop.
In your opinion, should the fodder that was transported to the north, should it have been checked before it was dropped into pastures ahead of time? Or
really don't think that's probably not realistic. I mean, you know, you couldn't really go through all the bales and see. I mean, you know, you're talking about seeds that might only be 1 or 2 millimetres long. So I don't think that is necessarily a practical outcome. I mean, it is just one of those situations where there are risks in this process.
You mentioned earlier that you'd like to see Biosecurity Queensland intervene. How would you like to see them help graziers that are dealing with these issues?
It'd certainly be helpful if there are more Queensland government officers actually, you know, visiting properties and offering to scout out tracts of country to see if, you know, weeds are off in distant places where they haven't been. I mean, you know, when you think about these very large pastoral holdings, you know, very, very large properties, it's not necessarily realistic that the landholder knows, you know, where every bit of prickly acacia is going to be, is in a position to monitor it. So, you know, the more eyes, the better. And so, you know, that kind of assistance. And also, you know, with the actual physical control. I mean, I've certainly been out to southwest Queensland around Thargominda, where Biosecurity Queensland was really hitting one of the mesquites really hard. I mean, it was Biosecurity Queensland gangs that were in there doing the spraying. You know, they do lend that kind of help at times. I hope that can be the case, but I also hope it isn't just a case of Biosecurity Queensland moving money around internally, that they do get an extra allocation from Treasury, because sometimes in these situations they'll pull money from the control of one weed and put it into another, and it's not necessarily a net gain for Queensland.
So are you looking for some sort of recovery funding to help graziers?
Yeah, I'm certainly not trying to spell out exactly the kind of assistance, but certainly calling on Biosecurity Queensland to do what it can to help the landholders in a time of need, you know, for an issue that isn't necessarily at the top of people's minds. I mean, this is potentially a very serious problem where it can get overlooked. You know, people a year from now start noticing all these extra weeds, and by then, you know, it's a bit late to be thinking about it. Well, it might not be. They might be still in a controllable stage, but an inch in time saves nine. I mean, that is so true about weed control.
Indeed it is. Tim Lowe from the Invasive Species Council of Australia. Anita Bolle reporting. 13 minutes to 1.
The Country Hour. on ABC Radio Queensland.
Well, from flooding rains to raging droughts, a grain and fodder marketer in Queensland says he's never seen such high levels of toxicity in sorghum crops off the Darling Downs. Tim Ford from Feed Central near Charlton is advising farmers to test both bought and grown sorghum before allowing cattle anywhere near it. It comes after 14 cattle died on a Stanthorpe property last week from prussic acid poisoning. Mr Ford told Maddie Wallace what he's noticing about crops coming in.
The thing that we're mainly involved with at the moment is the prussic acid and nitrates. As people are feeding and considering their options with failed forage sorghum and failed sorghum crop, that's the grain sorghum growers have got decisions to make about what they do with their grain sorghum crops. Some can graze, some might consider silage, some might consider hay. Those decisions the growers have to make right now.
Can you give me some numbers on the affected crops in the Southern Downs region?
I think the affected crops overall, drought-affected crops would be, I think everyone would agree that it'd be, you know, 100% of crops would be being affected by drought at the moment. In relation to the prussic acid and nitrates, we're doing a lot of testing and we're finding approximately 20% of the tests that we're doing are coming back at levels that would be unsafe to graze or unsafe to feed as hay for failed sorghum crops.
And have you ever seen anything on this scale before in a drought season or a dry season?
We have seen reports of prussic acid and nitrate quite frequently over the years, but nothing of this scale. It's normally very sporadic or very isolated pockets that can at times be very difficult to explain. But the widespread nature combined with the heat and so forth has led to a higher than normal incidence of prussic acid and nitrate toxicity in the sorghum crops.
So what can growers do testing-wise? How can they test for this kind of unsafe levels in their feed before they get to the point where they're losing cattle over it?
Yeah, there's a couple of different testing options. One is to submit a sample to a company like ourselves that can receive the sample and process it and test it for nitrate and prussic acid in-house. We've also partnered with another local company to develop a prussic acid on-farm testing kit for both prussic acid and nitrates, and that allows growers to test on-farm. It just gives a simple yes-no style answer. And that test gives a lot of convenience to people to be able to test on their own farm or to test hay that they might have bought and basically get an instant result.
What then can they do to prevent any more loss of feed or, in worst case scenario, cattle?
Yeah, once you know whether it's safe or not safe, you can proceed to get comprehensive tests done. There's a few things that can be done in ensuring, you know, introducing the stock slowly so that they're not allowed to gorge on the product. That seems, and it gives them time to get used to any toxicity that may be there. It's a simple matter of allowing the liver time to get used to it. It shouldn't make from the research I've done, it doesn't make the animals sick if you can introduce it to them very slowly and it won't cause them to die. Don't allow animals to gorge. Introduce them in the afternoon when the plant has had more time to photosynthesize since the morning. We really encourage people to work with their local input supplier and animal health supplier to get specific advice on what they need for their particular farm.
That's Tim Ford from Feed Central speaking there with Maddie Wallace. Well, to the wool market now, and China has suspended trade on South African wool following an outbreak of foot and mouth disease, and the impact has filtered through to this week's Australian wool sales. Prices were up $1 a kilo across all lines and couldn't have come at a better time for Australian producers who are battling drought. Mike Pritchard has this story.
Prices at yesterday's Melbourne sales skyrocketed across all lines and even crossed over onto the drought-affected wool. It's not sure how long the suspension order will be in place, but there was plenty of excitement on the sale floor. Elders Wool Technical Manager Craig Brennan says prices have been steadily rising this year, but this is extraordinary.
Due to the fact that Chinese customs have suspended all greasy wool imports from South Africa due to a foot and mouth disease outbreak. So it was decided that the sale on the 20th of February in South Africa was to be suspended, and consequently all the orders from that they would have normally purchased wool in South Africa have been transferred to Australia.
Do we know how long this suspension order is going to be in place?
It's unknown at this stage. I suppose it's up to now the South Africans to, you know, to sort it out and speak to the Chinese government and that sort of thing to see if they can resolve the issue. But definitely their misfortune is a short-term gain for Australian wool producers.
Did we see a significant price rise because of this?
Yeah, so consequently, you know, this time of the year, Australia has the most wool on offer anyway in the world. And without the South African market, it's just exacerbated the situation. So yesterday we've seen the market jump $1 a kilo right across the board, pretty much in all types, in all merino types, right through to the crossbred wool. So, yeah, right across the board. So, you know, buyers just scrambling for wool with the lack of the South African selection.
$1 a kilo, a significant jump.
And the market has been quite solid considering from Christmas, you know, even though a lot of the wool's unfortunately are drought affected, the market has been very solid anyway, and we're expecting the market, you know, to be slightly dearer this week, but nothing like we saw yesterday.
A boost for those suffering drought in the drought areas, of course, that are struggling to get the quality of their wool up.
The timing for this is, you know, couldn't be better actually. Next week is the Newcastle sale, the super fine offering. And look, some of the wools are still holding up reasonably well due to the drought conditions, and obviously some are carrying a lot more dust and lower tensile strength. But what we experienced yesterday in the marketplace, even the drought-affected wools yesterday, wools with lower newdons and high mid-breaks, they were very keenly sought after. So the demand is right across the board in all types, right through to your oddments and right through to the crossbred wools.
There are no other countries, then, that China can source their wool from?
Not with any sort of volume, Mike. Other countries like Argentina and that sort of thing, yeah. I mean, even Chinese's own supply of wool, it's the wrong time of the year. So, yeah, at the, you know, this sort of period now is really, Australia has the most volume in the world. So, all the pressure is now on Australia to supply, you know, and all countries with merino and crossbred wool.
That's Craig Brennan from Elders speaking there with Mike Pritchard. Very soon we're going to head to a property in between Kynuna and Winton on the banks of the Diamantina. We're going to check in with the Bat family very soon.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
We're at 7 minutes to one. In the aftermath of the devastating floods, it's hard to imagine a job any more thankless or heartbreaking than burying dead cattle. Yet in Western Queensland right now, there's a small band of volunteers who've mobilised manpower and machinery to help get the gruesome task done. David Batt and his wife Christine lost about 215 head of cattle and 2,000 head of sheep in the disaster. He told Christy Sexton-McGrath that he can't thank the blokes that have come to assist him enough.
Well, my son knew what one of these young blokes come off farms around Emerald, or not all of them, some of them. There's a plumber, one bloke's got a house removing business, there's a couple of ringers, and they'd been listening to it on the wireless and they wanted to come and do something, so they'll help at the end of it here in the Kimberley, all this livestock. And they've all got, well, there's two loaders, a bulldozer, a fairly big bobcat and an excavator. And they managed to get people who own big trucks and floats, they're big loaders, they had to have a big truck to get them out of here. Talked them into bringing them out for nothing. So the truck driver needs to be thanked first for bringing it out here. Then the blokes that owned the loaders came with them. And they brought all their own food, all their own fuel, enough cakes and biscuits to keep us going for a month. And they're living in the quarters down here. And they're doing, so started me and they're sort of headed north where the main deaths are. So they've done me and they've done me northern neighbour, then they've gone into another neighbour now to do them. They had about 10 days that they could do as much as they could in 10 days, and they've got to be home by then. Some of them are harvesting, some have got jobs. One of them's got a baby that's only a couple of weeks old, I think, so he's standing up on top of the quarters every night trying to ring his wife on a mobile, which it works, but he's up at the top there reporting in.
So have they finished up on your property now, or are they still going?
No, they've done me. They took them a while to get a bit of a sort of a pattern. It took a while to figure out how the best way to do it because they're a bit scattered here. So, but the dozer was the best for digging the holes and the loaders were best for pushing it in and the little bobcat thing was good for pulling them off fences. So they got a bit of a system going. And the first half a day they had a bit of trouble, but now they've got it going fairly well. They can get into it. They can bury a lot of cattle in a very short period of time.
What's it mean to you to be able to, you know, to bury those cattle, David?
Oh, we've got to get rid of them. move on. Get them out of sight and buried. And, you know, we can start again, get back in the game. And there's a disease and all that sort of thing. So they're best buried, of course.
What did the blokes say? Why did they want to do it?
Well, I heard some of the horrendous numbers that have been lost out here. You know, some people have lost 100%. The livestock, I've been lucky, only done half of them. So I've been hearing all this, and that's what mainly motivated them.
And, it's obviously a very heartbreaking situation for you, your wife, your family. Does this help, I guess?
Of course it does. I didn't know what I was going to do with them. All we could think to do was to let them all rot down, then we could deal with them with smaller tractors, which, you know, would have gone on for months. It was there to remind us every day of what had happened. So, no, it's a definite benefit. You know, to get something happening probably is the best thing about it. And we can all move on then.
Great. And how many other properties are they doing in that area?
I've only got 10 days, so they'll probably get on. You know, they might do four or five properties. It just depends how they're going. A couple of them, I think. Well, one bloke had to go to start harvesting, so he had to go. He may have to go shortly. So, you know, they can't stay forever. Or half a million cattle to bury, so they could be here for 6 months if they wanted to be.
That's David Batt. He and his wife Christine are at Newcan, 110 kilometres northwest of Winton. A glimmer of hope is the rallying of people to help those graziers clean up. Let's check markets now.
$60, $70, $60.
Straight to Cheryl Stevano, who has all the quotes from the Roma Prime Sale.
Good afternoon. Cattle numbers fell by 84 head to 508 at the Roma Prime Sale. A smaller panel of buyers was present and operating. Cows dominated the yarding, and the demand remained strong for the better quality lines. Prices fell for cows across most weight brackets, while quality bulls saw improvements. Medium weight 2-score cows fell by 9, and the medium weight 3-score cows fell by 4. Heavyweight 3-score cows fell by 2. Heavyweight bulls improved by 13. The best of the heavyweight grown steers sold to 276.2 to average 276, while the top heavyweight grown heifers sold to 251.2 to average 240. Medium weight 2-score cows made to 192.2 to average 175, while the medium weight 3-score cows sold to 227.2 to average 211. A good number of heavyweight 3-score cows sold to a top of 228.2 to average 219. The best sample of heavyweight bulls made to 259.2 to average 231. This has been Cheryl Stevano for the National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thanks, Cheryl. Well, the weekly Warwick sheep sale saw prices fall. Local agent Ross Ellis explains the continued drought is seeing more poorer quality animals hit the market.
Sheep were probably back a little bit. The market had a 50% increase on last week. Lambs topping at 189. But it's the important factor is the average for the yarding was $16 or $17 cheaper for lambs yesterday, reflected mainly because of the drier conditions, a few poorer, lighter lambs, and unfortunately a lot of next year's breeders being offered for sale.
That obviously doesn't usually happen, just a real indicator of how dry it is?
It is particularly important that people realise how dry the pastoral areas are getting. Water is our biggest major problem. You can feed them, but if you haven't got water, it's just not much fun.
It certainly is a major issue, Ross Ellis. We better keep talking sheep prices, though. What happened in terms of direct-to-works quotes?
Direct-to-works still on the same rate, at $6.80 or thereabouts. And mutton, very hard to access online. For the simple reason, we are seeing more mutton offered either direct to works, through the yards, or online. And that's an indicator that people are getting rid of their breeding stock. High percentage of ewes being offered, which is unusual for this time of the year, as we're moving into our main joining season.
Do you think people will hold off joining, just given the season?
A lot of people are holding off joining, which impacts on major ram sales, which happen around February, March. And until we get that break in the weather, unfortunately, Ali, we are not going to see much improvement.
Well, fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed, all right.
That's Ross Ellis. He's a local agent from Warwick. And that's all in the Country Hour for this Thursday. I'll be back same time tomorrow. It's news time now, 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.